Campus FM presents a talk in the series Rediscovering the Grand Master's Palace, entitled Domestic Arrangements at the Grand Master's Palace. This talk is delivered by Marquis Nicholas De Piro and is organized by the Office of the President.
Well, Your Excellency, ladies and gentlemen, good evening, in spite of its being not quite a welcome evening about the weather, but I say here that the palace is full to extreme this evening. Well, as I told you, this series of lectures, I have to thank His Excellency the President, who was enthusiastic, I would say, when I offered him the first time my plan of organizing lectures about rediscovering, as I said, the palace. There is a lot to rediscover about the palace, and also to discover as well. Well, this evening we set the ball rolling. Our dear friend Nicholas De Piro, who is going, his monument, I would say, are his two books, The Temple of the Knights, and of course, about the sovereign palaces of the knights. Well, his forte are the knights, but his fortissimo, I think, is the palace, as well as St. John's Cathedral, those two monuments that he has created. Well, this evening he's going to talk to us something about the almost a day. we just have to transport ourselves back in time about a day with the Grand Master. Well, there are nice things and not so many nice things, but in any case, I present you Marquis Nicholas De Piro.
Your Excellency, ladies and gentlemen, let me start before I start by being worth your while coming here. We're sitting here in a bit of a dream. This is nothing short of a royal palace. Like most grand concepts, there was a beginning, a heyday, a debasing, a revival, and now this wonderful palace seems set and settled for a long future at a level of domesticity which can be reborn with flair and fantasy according to the appropriate occasion, fitting into modern times. Once upon a time, Alof de Wignacourt, whom we remember particularly for his great project, patron of one of the world's greatest artists, Caravaggio, once upon a time he lived here. And soon after, another rather majestic character would be in charge. Antoine de Paule was of a social, one might almost say, voluptuous temperament. He introduced a greater degree of ceremony to the court than any of his predecessors. She lists the retinue of the new Grand Master as follows. One seneschal, this was a knight in charge of the household, a maître d'hôtel. He was responsible for the quality and presentation of the food. Among the valet de chambre and pantry servants, one butler, one steward, one keeper of the storeroom, three cooks, five scullions or kitchen maids. The bakery retinue included one miller, one man to distribute the corn, one man to compound the corn, six bakers. Of course, there would have to be a coffee maker, a rat catcher, four valets, 12 pages, four chaplains, one confessor, two physicians, an undisclosed number of bookkeepers, three secretaries to cope with the three main languages of the order, Latin, Italian, and French. There were 12 grooms, one gamekeeper in charge of hunting permits, one fencing master, one grammarian for the pages, one clock regulator, one house carpenter, a number of drummers, a number of trumpeters, just one wig maker, 8 chasseurs in case anybody in the household wished to go hunting, a good number of palace guards, the right number of stable hands and coachmen, a good number of very strong sedan chair carriers, a few archers, an adequate number of guardians of the palace slaves. This was the end of the first quarter of the 17th century, a time which saw change resulting from the tensions between the traditional religious versus the secular ideals of the order, with the worldly aspirations gaining ground. As time passed and the population of the Maltese islands grew, the people in the towns looked similar to those in most European cities, with an extra smattering of traders giving an occasionally Oriental look. The working people in the villages looked like Sicilian peasants. The knights wore black, and in the 18th century the norm was a frock coat, a waistcoat, breeches, buckled shoes. Most times a wig was worn, and the head was covered by a tricorn hat. There is a description by the Venetian ambassador Giacomo Cappello in 1716. His letter of credence to Grandmaster Ramon Perellos has appeared in a private collection and been properly identified. Cappello goes against the normal belief that everything always looked splendid in the city of the knights. He says, Valletta has lovely houses, straight but hilly streets. One can see certain knights about the city dressed in a manner to make one believe that they were the commonest of servants or rogues. We have another, arguably more reliable description, written later, which contradicts this. During the reign of the majestic Grandmaster Emmanuel Pinto, Mr. Bryden, an Englishman, fellow of the Royal Society, somebody not particularly disposed to be nice about the knights, and was certainly not a kowtowing nature, has the following to say. On getting on shore, we found ourselves in a new world indeed. The streets crowded with well-dressed people who have all the appearance of health and affluence. Many of the portraits and townscapes that survive confirm the second version, and it is generally known that relations were strained with Venice when Giacomo Cappello's special mission to Perellos failed back in 1716. The opulence and splendor of Pinto's court was recorded by Tiepolo, Favre, and a string of other lesser artists. Accounts of life in the auberges talk of eating on silver plate and the grandmaster's table, copying those of the other Christian monarchs. There were fine carriages all over the city, and the sedan chair was in common use. The grandmaster liked to be carried by Turks, and it is possible that this idea became smart and others would have copied him. Many local families owned slaves in the 18th century. They were expensive and were often shown off to their best advantage. A smart slave meant a smart master. The houses of Valletta were built with embellishments at every corner, and there is more than one good description of the night scene, with lights at all the niches giving a wonderful aura to the great conventual city. Perhaps it is time to focus on domestic arrangements within the walls of this palace. Let us start with manners and protocol. While delving into the past, I have tried to find all those tidbits of information which have not usually been considered to be of much importance. I believe that detail and manners talk history, and I think many of them are indeed important if we want to get the real atmosphere of the place. Who was it that really ran the Grandmaster's household? What did the Grandmaster's bedroom look like? And who made the furniture? Did he have more than one place to sleep in Valletta? Did he really go fishing? What a find that was. Something never published before. Who did he go with? What were his servants like? What were their jobs and specific responsibilities? What did everybody eat? Who bought the food? Was the charity work of the order a bluff? What kind of cheap wine did they serve the poor? The answer is, they served the best. How active were they? Did they relax? How formal was formal? We shall see. Did the Maltese feature in the running of the order's administration? The answer is yes. An emphatic and indisputable, unequivocal yes. Sometimes both of two important offices, the master of the household and the Grand Master's agent, were chosen from local families. If we think about when the knights came to Malta, we were all pretty poor. Even our ethnic aristocracy in Imdina and Marsa could not really compete or compare with the splendor and influence of the celibate blue-blooded new arrivals. Remember the great siege? Knights arriving with a ship or two, bringing a few hundred peasants off their estates to help? No individual Maltese nobleman had that kind of wealth, nor would he ever have, but things would get better than they had been. For the purposes of this talk, I have collected some material from selected happenings in this magisterial palace. Let us focus for a little around the reign of the Spanish Grand Master Perellos. He ruled from 1697 to 1720, that's for 23 years. At his accession, his mother country was theoretically ruled by the last Habsburg King of Spain, that ever ailing Charles II. France by the Sun King, Louis XIV, whose grandson would inherit Spain as a legacy and become Philip V. French and Spanish knights dominated the order. Our Perellos would live for 5 years into the reign of Louis XV, Louis XIV's great-grandson, and die soon after the transition between Habsburg and Bourbon Spain. In order to find the unusual, some overlooked detail perhaps, the unpublished and the fascinating, a researcher in Malta could delve into the old repertorio, the Conti della Ricetta Magistrale, and look at the day-to-day bills and payments being honored to support the royal style practiced by a grandmaster and his court. The National Library has information covering Derouan's reign from November the 12th, 1775, to July the 17th, 1797. An interesting note there claims that there is no trace in the National Archives of the Conti della Ricerca of any other Grand Master. In fact, some of Adrian Wignacourt's Conti della Ricerca have been found. So have Perellos's and Pinto's in private archives. We already know that the scene in Malta at the time of Perellos's election involved mainly French and Spanish factions. Perellos had his house guarded, for had he lost the election, only heaven knows what might have happened. Sounds a bit familiar. On being proclaimed Grand Master, one of the very first bills Perellos paid was to the guards who protected his house. Grand Master Ramon Perellos y Rocafull came to the throne on February the 7th, 1697. We know that he embellished the palace with Gobelin tapestry and also added new rooms to the piano nobile. If we focus on some payments he made in the first year of his reign, we may well find items of interest in lesser-known aspects of his life and the life of the palace. Some, I imagine, have not been concentrated upon previously. On February the 16th, Perellos, through his Ricevitore Commendatore Count Reckheim, who would then ostensibly give instructions to the appropriate clerk to carry out the payment, compensated Stefano Motet for settling some orders made on the Grand Master's behalf. The second payment was made to somebody who will go down in history as quello che fece l'epigramma, the one who wrote the poem. An adulatory ode would normally have been commissioned and was well paid. The poet received 3 gold zecchini, which, we are told, was the equivalent of 10 scudi. 9 days later, on February the 25th, the Grand Master approved the payment of 30 scudi to be handed over to the 2 sedan chair carriers of the late most eminent Grand Master Adrian de Wignacourt. 24 scudi were paid to repurchase their livery, which must have been in good condition. We could even surmise that it was given to them by the recently deceased Grand Master. It is doubtful that they could have bought it themselves, as the second part of the payment clearly states that the remaining 6 scudi was paid as their salary, covering 9 days at 4 tari per day. A new prince needed a seal of office. The job of producing 7 seals for Perellos fell to the Maltese master of the mint, that able silversmith, Mastro Carlo Troisi. On March the 25th, he was paid 64 scudi for the silver and manufacture of 5 seals. Part of the order was another smaller seal for the chancellery, and one more of the smaller type. The payment also covered a balsamina vinaigrette with the arms of the Grand Master. Troisi also produced fine engravings of the coat of arms of the Grand Master's on the Grand Master's bacilli, his toilet bowls, and received 6 gold zecchini for gilding them. Mind boggles. The Grand Master's person and the Grand Master's presence as the deliverer of Christianity had to look sensational. The standard had been set by Louis XIV, and opulence would become an obligation to reflect national prestige. On November the 11th, 1697, Perellos's Ricercatore paid the sum of 220 scudi to Bartolomeo Ruggiero and partners for 2 female Turkish schiavotte, young slaves. The elder was aged 12, and she was Bosnian and fair. Her name was Vora. The second was only 9 years old. She is described as nearly olivastra, certainly darker and presumably of an olive complexion. It is stated that they were bought on the direct orders of the new Grand Master. The contract was registered in the records of notary Aloisio de Lore. Exactly 1 month later, on December the 11th, a payment of 35 scudi, 6 tari and 3 grani was made for the manufacture of Indian costumes created for His Eminence's 2 schiavotte. So far, so good. But a month later, the large sum of 123 scudi and 13 grani is paid through Francesco Sanchez, whoever he was, specifically for brocade costumes made for His Eminence's 2 schiavotte. How sad that we have no good visual description of the Grand Master with his entourage en toute splendeur. It is interesting, perhaps, to note that Perellos's tailor in Malta was referred to as Signor and not as Mastro. We have his name. It was Ignazio Ferriolo. On December the 3rd, 1697, he was paid the sum of 51 scudi, 9 tari, and 10 grani for the cost of the material and the manufacture of una roba di camera di raso color di musco, which sounds like a rust-red satin dressing gown. The bill mentions but does not specify other clothes made for the person of His Eminence. Perellos constantly, over the years, paid for embellishments to his lovely garden in Valletta. It was, in a sense, the palace garden and carried the Grand Master's prestige. His botanical showpiece in Valletta, Jnini Sultan, was sometimes referred to as the Giardino della Marina, but it was his Valletta palace garden. Perellos paid 58 scudi for work on his garden in the first year of his reign. He would pay out much larger sums over the coming years. The names of the recipients of the bill have survived. They were Achille Vassallo and Antonino Bellaferran, who had painted balconies and windows and produced some ironwork. In the forthcoming years, there would be payments to Mastro Paolo Azzopardi and Antonio Camilleri for items such as canne grosse for his Valletta garden at the Porta dei Monti. Perellos wrote in his will, "There will be a charitable distribution of 2 tari each for those poor people who receive charity every morning in the garden of our palace, and for those, needy male or female, who receive charity from the stairs. They can receive 6 dari for the love of God and in aid of my soul. The Grand Master succored our Lords the sick at the Sacra Infermeria 3 times a week. He also fed 12 poor souls in a room on the ground floor of the palace every day. Knight's Grand Cross brought in the food on silver trays, and wine was also offered and sampled by His Eminence to make sure that the quality was the finest for the poor. Perellos took his obligations seriously, but as we have seen, he also liked the exotic. This is evident from his choice of decoration for the palace. If one were to have aviaries at the palace, then they would have to have been quite impressive. They had to be. The mentality of the times involved cutting the bella figura. Perellos could not allow some visiting grandee to see a miserly cage with scraggy birds at his magisterial palace. A payment of 25 scudi, 10 tari and 10 grani on May the 30th, 1697, was made to Giovanni Pace for supplies of tanta canabusa and scagliola for the 2 palace aviaries. If one compares this payment to a working man's wage of 4 tari a day, it does seem to be a considerable sum for bird supplies. Perellos was determined to convert the magisterial palace to a higher level of grace and dignity than ever before. He would leave his mark in more ways than one. His new rooms took 11 months to complete. The payment declares that grossi lavori were undertaken from July the 16th, 1697 to June the 9th, 1698. The result was the improved winter apartment and the restoration of the Casa dei Paggi and the palace terraces. The exercise cost 781 scudi, 21 tari, 28 grani. The ground floor of the palace must have been a hive of activity. The palace guard used the services of forzati, these were prisoners, who could volunteer for work in the stables away from their prison. Grooms were often recruited from among the slaves, and the strong and the useful were well employed. There would be no doubt be incentives for them if they behaved properly. Forzati were often used as oarsmen on the galleys and could prove useful during times of plague when the average undertaker was too frightened to bury the dead. It is recorded that in September 1697 the sum of 7 scudi was spent on refurbishing footwear for the forzati and slaves at the palace. 10 years on, Mastro Antonino Ciaret would supply 80 pairs of shoes for the kitchen slaves and those concerned with the ovens, the carriages, and the palace guard. It gives us a number of the sort of feeling of how many people were here, 80 pairs of shoes. We have the name of the palace blacksmith, Giacomo Bruno, who also acted as vet. He was paid 15 scudi for 1 month of providing his services. These involved shoeing and the medication of the carriage and cavalry horses of the palace and any other animals. The salaries paid to employees at the palace for the period of the first 9 months of Perellos' reign totaled 1,705 scudi, 2 tari. The total for the next 6 months amounted to 1,208 scudi. If costs kept increasing, even marginally, the Grand Master would be spending about 2,400 scudi a year on wages alone. I have picked out a few items for the coming years. Mastro Domenico di Bella supplied the Grand Master with an iron bed and was paid on the 22nd of March 1701. We do not have its description other than that it was made for the summer apartment, the winter and the summer apartment, and that it cost 14 scudi, 1 tari, 5 grani. In May, 27 scudi was paid for borders, called passamani, and fringes, frangia, per il letto d'estate. There is a payment in September for satin upholstery, tappezzerie de panni di razza, or razza. And at about the same time, the passamantieri, Gaspare Violi and Carlo Calleja, were paid 104 scudi for supplying 83 libre, pounds weight, of edging in silver and gold. On November, a fine bed cover was delivered to the Cameriere Maggiore for His Eminence's bedstead, and it cost more than double the price of the bed. Before judging the past too harshly, we should always consider the circumstances where keeping up prestige was deemed to be an obligation. Status was boosted not only for the order itself vis-à-vis other courts, but in Malta's special circumstances. A Spanish Grand Master had to be as fine as a French one, and so on. News would have reached Malta about the French king's levées, grand levées and petit levées, in short, the formal and even more formal ceremonial for the king's rising, his getting out of bed. Everything had to be grand if one was not to lose face. Malta was small and needed to be noticed. Malta had to be grand if she was to be significant. On November the 4th, 1707, the palace agent, as it happens, my direct ancestor, Gio Pio de Piero, was paid the final balance of a bill of 472 scudi, 7 tari and 14 grani, for the expenses incurred in purchasing two chairs, carved, fretworked, and gilded. They were made for the use of His Eminence in his winter apartment. If we were to work out the equivalent cost of by today's standards, and if we were to judge according to the wage paid to the sedan chair carriers, for example, we could calculate that the cost of the two chairs amounted to the equivalent of 1,417 working days. 4 months later, Niccolò Malatesta supplied the palace with two carpets, costing 51 scudi each. It would be interesting to know whether they were locally woven or not, as is more likely to be the case, because the knights' internationalism, if they were European or Oriental, well, who knows? We do not know. I think, considering the subject of my speech, I should mention the following. It is about a maid on the piano nobile. Her name was Angelica Danna. She sounds like an old faithful, and I would like to surmise that she served Perellos probably before he became Grand Master. She was possibly resident in the palace, as in May 1707, her window was repaired in the summer apartment. Her name appears on other occasions when shoes are bought for her and even a cape, perhaps some version of the faldetta. Angelica was the Grand Master's personal lavandaia, the washerwoman. I would like to think that this woman was the only person allowed to see his unmentionables. A small staircase was specially built for her in the winter apartment to help her with her work. The idea of safeguarding the privacy of His Eminence's underwear does inevitably come to mind. One would imagine that Angelica had little or nothing to do with the laundering of quantities of cotton and linen needed for the Grand Master's table and the other tables of the palace. We do have some details of the replenishments of these items. Geronimo Grech supplied the palace with just over 46 meters, 22 canne, of napkin linen, costing marginally over 22 scudi in 1699. The creation of fine quality lace in Malta in the 18th century resulted from the demands of fashion. Finesse was de rigueur. In the upper echelons of European society, the lace worn by both gentlemen and ladies had to look delicate, intricate, and consequently costly. Some gentlemen spent more on lace than their wives did. Morta did very well indeed. Portraits by Antoine Favre and Francesco Zara give testimony to the skills of local lace makers. Cotton and silk were produced in Malta as the climate was favourable. Cotton fields were everywhere, and grandmasters planted mulberry trees as the leaves were the main source of nourishment for silk-producing worms. There are two entries in the Mandati di Pagamento del Cameriere Maggiore for the period 1701 to 1708. Lace was bought for the palace by length, but the width is sadly not mentioned. The first order delivered was for approximately 48 meters and is described as 23 canne of various lace. It averages out at about 2 scudi per meter. The payment was made to the Maestre Pizzillare, and through the connotations of those words, we can presume that what was being provided was the best, Maestre. The second order is delivered 3 months later in January 1705. It is a smaller order, but presumably the lace is finer, or perhaps of greater width. We also have a name. The order was for 4 meters of lace, and this time it was paid for at the higher price of 5 scudi a meter. The woman who provided the lace was called Madame La Fontaine. She spent a day at the palace sewing the lace onto, oh, if we only knew onto what. Perhaps it was the Grand Master's great napkin, which was also handed to him by that most senior official of the palace, the Senescalco. Perhaps it was the Grand Master's jabots. We shall probably never know. We can come to an interesting conclusion. Here, the social structure certainly respected skill more than brawn. The local seamstresses were paid 6 times more than a sedan chair carrier for a day's work. I thought I'd put this in, it's very short. Perellos liked fishing. The proof is that a payment of 17 scudi and 5 tari was made through Francesco Sanchez, the guardarobbia, keeper of the wardrobe, for expenses incurred in connection with the boats on August the 29th, 1699, the day when His Eminence went fishing, nel giorno della pesca di sua eminenza. I wonder what clothes the guardaroba produced for that occasion. The prince was certainly fishing again on March the 4th at the Lazzaretto, and again on the 30th of the same month, in 1706, aided by Vincenzo Bonnici and his fishing companions. The expenses were settled by Giovanni Gurgion, the Grand Maestro di Sala. This is clearly an unusual glimpse of the Grand Master. Another unusual glimpse allows us to observe the situation when, a couple of decades earlier, a previous Grand Master has a cold. On April the 23rd, 1681, Grand Master Gregorio Caraffa was in bed with a cold. He was occupying the winter apartment of the palace in Valletta. It is likely that he would have asked his chambrier to summon the Grand Mastro di Sala for a conference to discuss the happenings at the palace. This was the day when the Marchese di Solera, son of the Viceroy of Sicily, the Conte di Santo Stefano, was due to arrive in Malta and stay at the palace. It appears that this was a very friendly visit. It was agreed that in order to pay him due honour, the Marchese would be comfortably housed in the summer quarters of the palace. In order to avoid formality, he could pass through the secret door to the Grand Master's bedroom, and so was able to visit him twice a day until his departure 6 days later. It is recorded that they enjoyed each other's company without ceremony. Let us observe a reception, a baptism. Yes, indeed, the time has come to describe a party at the palace. Here we have the christening of a Maltese child. During the reign of that most regal of Grand Masters, Fra Emmanuel Pinto y Fonseca. The infant is the son and heir of Baron Don Giovan Cisco D'Amico Inguanes and noble Donna Asteria Testaferrata. It was decided that he would be given the name of Emmanuel after the Grand Master. The honor, the compliment to the people of Malta would be considered significant. The ceremony was conducted by none other than the highest prelate of the order, who was second only to the Grand Master himself, the prior of the sovereign order, Fra Domenico Mainardi. The ceremony was held in the Magisterial Palace Chapel in Valletta under the exquisite frescoes of Filippo Palladini. Pinto, the godfather, was in the 24th year of his 32-year reign. It was 1765 on April the 28th. The document is rich with detail and might fascinate those who wish to look further into 18th century life at the palace. In it we observe the manner in which guests were received. There is music laid on. We encounter a cameriere maggiore, a ricevitore, a cavallerizzo minore, and there is mention of the maestro di casa. Chatting with the Grand Master are a Vice Chancellor and an all-important Senescalco. There are chocolates, confits, and biscottini, and many knights mixing with the nationals, as they were always referred to. The altar decorations are described in great detail. Silver candlesticks, more than 40 in the chapel alone. Also, the carpets, damask, and more silver, as well as some of the finest ceremonial paraphernalia. There are young pages carrying torches. Bocchetti are given to the ladies involved in the ceremony. The guests eventually leave in carriages and calesses. They have been accompanied up and now are accompanied down the stairs. The midwife and the woman carrying the baby both get a good tip from the prince. It's rather nice, I thought. The Grand Master himself also receives a bouquet of silver flowers. Can we ask for more, other than what each person was wearing and what they were saying? We have it all. Perhaps I have not said enough about protocol. Of course protocol still exists, but today formality, seen in hindsight, can look a little bit quaint and even amusing. Listen to this. If you had an appointment to meet the Grand Master, there was a variety of ways in which you might have been received. One, you could have been ushered up the staircase by a page and reached your destination, where you would have been shown into the Grand Master's study, where he would have been sitting down. Two, you could have been ushered up the staircase by a page and reached your destination, where you would have been shown into the Grand Master's study, where he would have been standing up, a bit more welcoming. Three, you could have been ushered up the staircase by a page, and having reached the top, you would have been handed over to the cameriere maggiore, or even perhaps the senescal, who was an actual knight. You would then be presented to the Grand Master, who may have been standing outside the doorway of the room in which he was going to receive you. It's getting better. You could have been met and ushered up the staircase by none other than the cameriere maggiore, and having reached the top, you would have been handed over to the senescalco. You would have then been presented to the Grand Master in one of the staterooms. You could have been met at the bottom of the staircase by the senescalco and accompanied up the stairs to find the Grand Master waiting at the top of the staircase. What a compliment! And six, finally, this is nothing short of ecstasy. You would have had to be so important, and somebody to whom the Grand Master was most indebted. Rare, rare. More likely if you were a reigning prince, if the Grand Master met you at the bottom of the stairs. Finally, right here in Valletta, let us take a look at cooks and kitchens, and let us see what Giovanni Gurjon, the Maltese Grand Maestro di Sala, is buying for the palace cooks to produce their daily fare. There were two kitchens in the Valletta Palace at the beginning of the 18th century. We get an idea of their potential when we find that 21 scudi were paid to Master Antonino Vannada for repairing 96 brass pots and pans from the two kitchens. We have the name of the man whose office or function it was to be capo della guardamangia. His name was Motet, Stefano Motet. We've heard of him already. He seems to be safely ensconced in his occupation, but we have met him before. He is the man who organized the guarding of Perellos's house at the time of his election. Motet would be asked by the Mastro di Casa to pay off the suppliers. Just listen to this list of some of the day-to-day items purchased for the palace kitchens. This is not their whole stock, but just a good sheria to replenish the larder. Okay, here we go. English butter, burro butrio d'Inghilterra, 2 barrels costing 18 scudi. Cheese, formaggio, Dutch cheese, broad beans, figs, garlic, aglio grosso, vinegar, a quantity of fish, peas from Auvergne, salami, soppressate, Sicilian beans, Gossetan beans. I wonder what the difference is. Lentils, marzipan, pasta reale, sugar, Spanish oil, 86 hams, lard, olives, salted eels, smoked herrings, merluzzi, salmon, anchovy, capers, 289 bergamot pears, prunes, Levantine rice, rice flour, farina di riso, a good stock of Muscatello wine, and sapone bianco, soap. Between 1701 and 1708, the palace bought a quantity of logs, legna da bruciale, from Pantelleria. A number of merchants were used. One dealer called Giacomo Guicciardi is recorded as having gone bankrupt in later years. Perhaps selling firewood was not such a good business. However, Malta, with so few trees, would have needed a large amount of burning fuel in the 18th century and in the centuries before. Benedetto Assa is another name that turns up as a vendor of wood and charcoal. In January 1706, Giovanni Gurjon asked his son-in-law, now the Grand Master's ambassador in Licata, to provide him with 2,500 brooms and brushes for the palace, for which he paid 32 scudi. This has only been a glimpse of happenings in one of the three principal palaces. I have enough information to give you which would keep us here all evening, but perhaps you have heard enough for today, and thank you for listening. I hope I'm not going to be asked to answer difficult questions. Am I expected to answer questions? Should we try one? Sir?
Well documented in this matter. You gave him as the reference, and I'm writing a dissertation now on his relations with Louis XIV. So I wondered where your great sources are.
Well, one thing we do have in Malta is we do have incredible quantity of sources. The problem is not having read them all. It's so much. You know, forgetting the palace here, I mean, just go up to Imdina, the whole inquisitorial archives are complete. Even my humble archives in my house down the road, you know, I've a lot of I got from there. But of course we've also used the state archives. Italian was the official language of the order. the lingua franca of the order, and a lot of Maltese people. I mean, you know that in 1830 it was the courts. Italian was used a lot.
Even though there were several French knights.
Well, French became very smart. I have found in some archives that if you are a bit pretentious, si pretende, and you wanted to educate your daughter to really be very eligible in the 18th century, you taught her some French. It was becoming very smart. And of course we know that through Russia. In Russia, a lot of the aristocracy were learning to speak French. One of those extraordinary phenomena, isn't it? But anyway, why? Don't ask me why. I don't know.
Joseph Muscat, whom we all know, is going to deliver a lecture. His chief
aim is about boat building and ship building and whatnot. No, he's an expert. I would rather say a European expert. But he discovered that 70%, these are common people, of those who worked in the shipbuilding, 70% of Maltese words that have to do with shipbuilding are French, not Maltese. It's incredible what he managed to discover. He mentions 45 words out of about 50 or 60 that are French origin, which means this is a bit a fallacy, because many think that French was during the French when they came to Malta. No, it was before, because the majority were French, and French was quite popular, not with the people, but this is important. Eh? Yes, and let's not forget that in Marseille, documents were found that stated, if you want a good sailor, go to Malta. Thank you very much.
You have just listened to a talk in the series Rediscovering the Grand Master's Palace, entitled Domestic Arrangements at the Grand Master's Palace. This talk was delivered by Marquis Nicolas DePiro and was organized by the Office of the President.